Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I've got like an insane like work ethic. So I'm like, I have to be there. Got to finish it. But it's not really working. It's sort of like having that obsession isn't helping the project. And if I take a couple of hours off and I read a book and I go for a walk and I come back, I'll finish it in 15 minutes.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to writer, director, producer and performer Hayden Prowse. Perfect.
Hi, this is Steve Whiteley, comedian, actor, filmmaker and writer, all-round ADHD creative. And welcome to my new podcast, Balancing Acts, where I talk to an array of creatives ranging from comedians, actors, directors, all sorts. And we talk about how they find a sense of balance or not between their creative lives and their everyday lives and how that has an impact on their mental health and beyond.
Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out. Hayden kicked off his career working for online magazine Don't Panic, where he created and starred in numerous satirical viral videos. He's also directed documentaries for the likes of Vice and The Guardian, as well as presenting documentaries for BBC and Channel 4. And he, of course, co-created, wrote and starred in BBC Three's The Revolution Will Be Televised, which won a BAFTA, a Rose d'Or and a Broadcast Award over 3 seasons. Hayden's other credits include Democracy Dealers on BBC Three, Revolting on BBC Two, The Ministry of Justice on Channel 4, a three-part satirical comedy series, in which he starred alongside his partner in crime, Jolyon Rubinstein. Hayden also hosted and wrote the BBC Two documentary, The Town That Took on the Taxman, and also presented The Most Dangerous Town on the Internet, which won 2 Cannes Lion Golds. So he has done a lot, and I'm missing out loads of other stuff as well. But needless to say, it was great to sit down and talk with him about his whole journey, starting off creating online content and then moving into TV. We cover loads and loads of ground. Hayden breaks down how he got into making hidden camera political stunts on YouTube with Don't Panic. He describes what it was like outing MPs who consequently lost their jobs as a result of his stunts and the anxiety that came with dealing with the aftermath. Hayden describes what it was like being behind these illegal stunts that could have imprisoned him and the adrenaline rush that comes with that, and then dealing with the crash after filming these stunts and scenes. He explains why he thinks it was unwise to lose skills in producing and directing as he became more and more front of camera talent. We talk about suffering from imposter syndrome, the idea of being an introverted performer, how social media has been a level playing field in comedy, but also with that comes the curse of democratizing content, which means that people on TikTok are getting way more views than people that are saving away making films or scripts, etc. But that's the way of the world right now. I'm actually you know, learning some dance moves at the moment. I think, I might go for sort of, the Israeli dancing. Yeah, I'm going to go for like a hip hop version of Israeli dancing. And I think it's going to blow up. I'm not. I should.
Hayden breaks down the struggles of pitching to commissioners and he explains how The Revolution Will Be Televised got made, why he's decided to focus on creating mainstream entertainment content, and he describes the challenge of making a good living working in TV. We talk about the Spotify series he's created, Sex Lies and DM Slides, and how that came about. And Hayden explains some of the terminology that is used in the modern dating scene, such as breadcrumbing. I'd never heard of it before. I'm clearly spending my days hiding under a rock. Hayden talks about why it's not necessarily to have an agent anymore, and the strength of being part of a network and the opportunities that arise as a result, i.e. sort of a network of fellow performers, that type of thing, and how success and awards breed more work opportunities. He describes how a Made in Chelsea star nicked his BAFTA. He explains why he wears so many creative hats. We talk about the idea of constructive procrastination, how to deal with script notes from execs. There is loads here. I think you're going to love this conversation. So if you are a writer, director, performer, aspiring satirical comedian or producer, then this is for you, because Hayden has done it all, as you'll hear more about in this conversation. So I mentioned in the previous episode that I started Thai boxing. Well, I had my first sparring sessions this week and got absolutely battered. I have purple and blue legs right now. But gotta say, I really loved it. Just gives me a proper adrenaline rush. That kickstarting your day, you know, beating the fuck out of someone, or them beating the fuck out of you, more likely, is a game changer for me. So if you do see me with a black eye anytime soon, then you'll know why. Remember, if you like this episode, please do subscribe if you haven't done already. Rate and review it on Apple. All the good stuff. So without further ado, over to Hayden. Perfect.
Did you have like an intention in mind when you started off making videos and doing sort of these hidden camera pranks and stunts? Did you have an end goal of what you wanted to achieve, or was it sort of?
No, not at all. And it kept changing as well. In fact, that was a big thing for me in terms of, you know, if we're talking about creativity and careers and stuff. I remember before I started doing those videos, I was in a real period of kind of depression. I was feeling really shit about myself. I had no confidence. It was this feeling a lot of people get, I think, in their late 20s, where they still can be whenever, but where they start to suspect somewhere in their mind that all of the things that they dreamed of might not actually come true in the way that they thought they would. And I was convinced I was going to be like a novelist. I just wasn't able to write a good novel. I wrote something. I sent it to a friend who was an agent. She sort of was like, it was just so fucking indulgent and ridiculous. And then I sort of stumbled into, I remember I did like a journalism sort of course, like a couple of month type thing, and then came out of it and then stumbled into this job at Don't Panic, where I was just luckily able to just make any video I wanted and create any content that I wanted. With Joe, who was my sort of boss at the time at Don't Panic. And we just ended up getting on really well and having the same kind of humour and interests in politics. And then, you know, it coincided with the whole YouTube, Facebook thing that was just kicking off in like 2006, 2007. And suddenly, yeah, found myself doing something that I enjoyed and seemed to be quite good at. But yeah, no sort of game plan whatsoever at all. And didn't realise that that was something that I even wanted to do, make films.
So you just stumbled across it.
Yeah.
And it just sort of spiralled from there.
Basically, yeah.
And the things that you were doing were pretty ballsy and received a lot of media attention.
Yeah.
How was that? How did that make you feel? Getting the spotlight on you.
Yeah. It was a weird feeling, because it made me slightly mad, actually. Because it was... I was writing about this the other day, because it was at the very beginning of all this internet madness, right? Where public shaming wasn't a thing to the same degree.
Yeah.
And I was going in and like secretly recording MPs in Parliament and getting them fired. And, you know, everyone on the internet would be like, "You're a hero. Well done. That's amazing. You got this guy fired." And I'd be like, "Yeah, he was a Tory. Fuck him."
Yeah, right.
And I'd feel really good about myself, and like people would say what you just said. They'd message me being like, "You've got such big balls." I'd be like, "Yeah, I've got such big balls." And then, but then something, I think I had this moment, and I think I became quite, kind of obsessed with doing it, and like I bought the idea. I was like, I sold into my own sort of idea, where I was like this brave hero, like sort of fighting the good fight against the man. And then I did one where I got a guy fired who worked, he was a sort of mid-level sort of government advisor, and he'd done something quite shitty, but it wasn't him. It was like, it was the department that was a problem. And I sold the story to the Telegraph, and the Telegraph were like, and I was like, can we not put his name in it? Because it's not about him. It's about the department. And they were like, what kind of fuck, what, you know, what are you?
Was this the one where you recorded the conversation at the House of Commons?
Is it? This is another one. No, right, I'd already got the MP fired, and there was backlash to that, and people and I, in something in me was, there was something I felt wasn't right. Like, people would criticize me for it, being like, who the fuck are you to go and get this guy fired? And, you know, I believed in the politics of why I'd done it, but something was like, I felt, I don't think I knew what it was, but I felt something was a bit wrong with what was going on, to be honest. And when I did this other thing, and then the Telegraph were like, we've got to name him, or you're not a real journalist. And I was like, okay. And they named him, and he lost his job, and probably, I don't know, struggled to pay his mortgage or his rent or whatever. He, I'm sure, had kids. Like,
you don't think about those things at that time, right?
But that's what made me think about that stuff. Okay. And partly why I went into comedy. And I just think it's interesting now to see so many people, because this was like, you know, 2009, 10, when all of this stuff was becoming a thing, right? You know, the internet, anyone could be a journalist. And it's interesting to see that, like, on steroids now. Everyone's just fucking trying to, you know, denounce each other and cancel each other and shout at each other and scream at each other left, right and centre.
Do you think that if you had started doing those stunts now and started your career now in these times, you would have had the same sort of path? Or do you think because of cancel culture, et cetera, you would have just been kicked out early doors or just planned pylons, et cetera?
I think we probably would have done, it would have been bigger.
Really? Okay.
Because I was all about cancelling people. Like,
right, yeah.
I'd go and I'd go to an MP's house who fiddled their expenses, and I'd like do criminal damage in his garden. Like, I'd dig up his garden, and like people would be like, yeah. And I'd be like, yeah. And then people love that shit now. People will go crazy for that. But I just don't want to do that anymore because it's gross, I think, what's happening. I think it's not helping.
Yeah.
And it's kind of obscene in a way.
I feel like you've always been very good at just sort of stating, getting your opinions out there. And I feel like in comedy at the moment, it's like, it's such a precipice at the moment to try and even, I mean, I've seen so many times I've just written a tweet or something, like, oh, I don't know, a bit controversial, and then just deleted it.
Totally. And you have that anxiety, you do the tweet.
Fucking,
and you sit there for like 20 minutes. You've got work to do, but you've just got this anxiety in your stomach. Like, did I say something bad? Is that?
Yeah.
Am I a bad person?
It's crazy. Did you have elements of that anxiety at the time when you released those videos?
Yeah.
In terms of what the feedback would be and then in the comments and so forth?
Yeah, I really did. Like, I remember going on news, and I remember doing it. I remember when I got the Tory MP fired, and then someone from The Guardian calling me up and saying, do you feel bad about what you've done? And I said, oh God, yeah, I do a bit. And that was the headline. And then I remember some PR person saying to me, what are you doing? You've got to like own what you've done and be really like confident about it. I was like, okay, I'll be that. And then we went on Newsnight, and some guy, Ian Dale, who's a Tory blogger, now sort of like pundit, was like, oh, your parents should be ashamed of yourself. Yeah, and I had that weird feeling, but I was sort of running into it because I kind of knew that, and that is that's how you do it now, right? It's like you've got your audience, you only speak to your audience. You know, if you do a tweet, it's got to speak only to that audience, and that's how you get the most retweets. If you're disgusted at Boris Johnson or you're outraged about Brexit or whatever, you know, even if you've done a similar tweet for the last fucking 3 years, you know that's the tweet that's going to get the most retweets. You know that's what's going to get the most traction.
Right.
I don't know. You can't, there's no room for self-reflection or nuance, is there? I don't know.
So will you say that when you tweet, do you think you take on a heightened version of your persona?
I actively try to tweet shit that, like, I think people who follow me might disagree with.
Right.
Because I feel like, what's the point?
Yeah.
If we're all just in our...
Do you enjoy that conflict that comes with that, or debate, if you can call it debate.
I don't know. How do you feel? Do you not feel like
I'm not in the same world as you. Like I take my hat off to you because I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
I
can either, to be honest.
But does it still affect you, sort of like mentally and emotionally, like to this day, or are you sort of so used to it and it's just part and parcel of what you do that you just sort of get on with it?
I know. It really affects me. But what when you say you get nervous to tweet things, what are the things that you're nervous to tweet about?
Those are stupid things. Yesterday, I thought I'd do like a funny joke about, oh, we should feel sorry for all. You know, who's thinking about all the males at this time?
Yeah.
With man flu, COVID has made us a marginalised voice.
Yeah.
And then I decided to I decided to delete it.
Man flu, yeah.
Stupid.
No one cares about man flu.
No one cares about man flu.
Yeah.
But I overthought it and then I deleted it.
No, but that's exactly, so it isn't so different. That's exactly the sort of thing I get nervous about.
Right.
Because generally I don't, I mean, there are some people that just tweet, they think it's their responsibility to sort of just retweet The Guardian. It's like,
yeah, right.
I can go to The Guardian, mate. Thanks. But like, I tend to try to do, you know, like, I don't know, make a joke or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get nervous about exactly those types of things.
So, and we're fast forwarding a little bit then. So what was it like then? Was it that sort of anxiety on steroids once The Revolution Will Be Televised came out? Because you then go from being online sort of...
Well, no, actually, Revolution Will Be Televised was on BBC.
Yeah.
And we were lawyered up and... there was no comeback ever. We were totally insulated. Like, doing it online on your own is scary because, you know, I almost got sued a number of times.
Right.
I could have gone to prison. So I did stuff that was like, you know, like I went filming in the Houses of Parliament in the way that I did it is not legal. And a lawyer said to me, don't release that because that'll be it for you. And I did it anyway. And it was scary. And I did like really scary stuff and I had no backup. Whereas in the BBC... you're completely insulated. You don't, everything goes through a million sort of editorial policy people and lawyers. By the time it comes out, you're like, you're fine. The worst controversy we had was when we did Real Housewives of ISIS.
Oh, yeah.
In our revolting.
Wasn't that the most viral clip from the series?
Yeah, it was like one of the most viral clips the BBC ever put out because it was just at that time in like 2016 where, like, you know, identity politics was going crazy and all the sort of Brexit faction or the Trump factions and everyone was kind of hating each other. And then we put out this thing and it was, everyone was like, it's racist and it's not racist. It is racist. It's not. And then you got messages from friends that you went to uni with being like, I thought I knew who you were.
Wow. Really?
How could you put that out? It's so racist.
And how did you respond to them? Or did you respond?
I did. Weirdly, I didn't care in the same way that I would care if I did a tweet because it had been through so many people. We'd all discussed it so heavily with people at editorial policy, with lawyers, with the production crew. And I was confident in what the sketch was. I didn't feel like it was racist at all. I think it was taking the piss out of specifically people that join Islamic State. And I think it's fine to take the piss out of people that join Islamic State. If you're in a world where you can't take the piss out of people that join Islamic State, it's bad. So I was cool with it, but it's different if you don't have that sort of institution behind you.
Yeah, you're not lawyered up. And then when you got the show commissioned, was that a moment of joy? Was that, okay, great, I've done this, and this, and now I'm at this point? And I guess it goes back to that earlier question of was that always like part of the vision?
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of was. No, I was just sort of stumbling into it because I ended up, you know, I wanted to, when I was making films for Don't Panic, I was directing and producing films and, you know, then when I did the show, I was, you know, writing and performing. So the writing I was still doing, which was great, but I never really wanted to be like, I kind of really wanted to direct and write more than I wanted to write and perform. But I ended up being on screen for like 8-9 years and then I lost a bunch of experience and skills in the sort of producing and directing side of TV and film, which was a bit unwise, I think, from a career perspective, because on-screen stuff just doesn't last forever. I mean, there's for a handful of people for whom it does, but most people, you know, have on-screen careers and then don't, or do to a lesser degree. And Yeah, most of what I do now is writing and directing and producing. But there is a period, there's a bit of a gap in my CV from that perspective, right? Because I was performing.
Right. So that during that period of time, you weren't doing any writing, directing, producing so much.
I was writing, but not really direct. I was doing some directing, but not enough. So yeah, I kind of stumbled into that as well. But then I guess, I don't know. Does anyone in TV and media have a proper plan?
I don't know,
if you're a doctor or a lawyer, I don't know.
It's such a weird, obscure career, isn't it? I always feel like, I just stumbled into what I'm doing and feel like some kind of outsider and always have imposter syndrome. Is that something you suffer from?
Yeah, all the time. Do you feel like you have imposter syndrome when you're on stage doing stand-up?
At the beginning when I died all the time.
Yeah.
And it's more the bits sometimes after or before.
Yeah. Yes.
It's sort of like the socializing with other comedians because I'm not really... And this actually was a takeaway from when I used to do improv before stand-up. I never really liked being on. I wanted to just have a normal chat with people.
Yeah.
And people were just like, you know, cracking jokes.
Totally.
I found that very uncomfortable.
Do you get the feeling after you come off stage or after you film a scene or something, do you get like a dip?
The crash,
Right.
Did you suffer from that during the filming of the show and also during sort of your hidden camera shows, the hidden camera stuff you did before?
I was quite unhealthy actually that entire period of my life because not only were we doing sketches and scenes, but we were doing like highly like adrenalized scenes, like sneaking into Tony Blair's house or fucking, you know, getting to David Cameron or Bill Clinton and like dodging through, literally like evading Secret Service in a hotel somewhere in fucking Detroit to get to Bill Clinton and then cracking some jokes to Bill Clinton, being like, you know, making some innuendos about fucking, you know, spunking and blowjobs in front of the Secret Service to his face. You know, literally saying, "Do you get my jizz, Bill? Do you get my jizz?" to his face, and then having the security like highly, highly adrenalized, and then you'd have these huge peaks, and then you'd crash straight away. But I think some people crash more than others. I think some people are much more, extroverts are like better with that sort of stuff, I think.
So what would you say, that you are naturally an introvert who has fallen into the performing side of things?
I think so, yeah. Right. There are lots of performers that are introverts.
Yeah.
And I think like in comedy, you know, like for instance, I was watching this great, I don't know if you've seen it, Mo Gilligan's doc on...
I've been meaning to. It's just come out.
Black, British and Funny. Yeah. It's really good and actually quite shocking. What, you know, sort of just the history of how few black hosted shows there have been.
Matt, I did a gig... not to cover the tangent, but I did a gig. I never forget this. I used to present on a radio show back in the day in Halsden, and there was a guy there called Jeff Schumann, who's a legendary comedian on the black circuit.
Mm.
And he used to talk to me about his gigs, and this was before I got into comedy. Yeah. And I'd never really sort of seen perform, but I did a gig with him in Tottenham about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
He killed, destroyed.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, how is this guy not massive?
Not fucking on primetime BBC channel?
It's crazy.
No, I see that all the time.
It's a travesty.
Time. Yeah. It really is. But it isn't just about colour. Like, that happens to so many people, or sex or anything like that. People are kind of obsessed with these sorts of things now, I think. But it does happen to everyone. Of course, it's messed up that his show with Big Nasty is the first black-only hosted chat show in 20 years since Blackwood, Richard Blackwood, did his. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
And the one before that was Red Nose Day.
Oh, Lenny Henry.
So the one before that was Lenny Henry.
Yeah.
So like 20 years apart, each was 20 years apart, and they haven't been. And they talk about how there were times when, in fact, KG and Marston, who I've worked with for years, they worked on a bunch of shows. I got them in to work on a bunch of shows.
KG?
Yeah,
he's funny.
He's amazing.
He's funny.
So when I saw Guns and Pork and the one where he's on the roller skates.
The roller skates one just cracked me up with the dog as well.
With the dog, yeah. It's fucking brilliant.
Brilliant.
And as soon as I saw that, I got him in to Don't Panic, where I was doing all my films from.
Yeah.
And we started making sketches together. What did we do? We did a few really funny ones. But now he's doing really well. He's fucking killing it.
Yeah.
Finally, because he deserved that. He did that amazing thing at the Brits. Where the Mobos, where they they like pranked Leisha Dixon.
I didn't see that.
And they had these like fake R&B characters, and they started to like hit on her live in front of the audience. It was huge. Yeah. And then he was saying how he got the bus home after that night, and they were on this high. They were like superstars, and then when they were on the 149 on the way home,
wow.
Like, you know, and it's taken him. That's been another 10 years since he did that, and he's only just starting to get the recognition. He should have had a TV show like 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, Mo Gilligan, if he hadn't of obviously started doing videos on Instagram, and then probably wouldn't be where he is. Because he was doing live for about 8 years or so prior to start doing that.
Right. Fuck. Yeah, I mean, social media is amazing in that way. It's a leveler. Because these fucking commissioners that for so long have decided what the demographics are and how many black people are allowed to host a show or what humor is, and people aren't ready for that type of humor, and that script is too avant-garde and too weird, like people aren't going to get it. Finally, we're able to bypass them because they don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Have you found that, have you had challenging experiences when pitching? Because you must have had so many ideas that you've pitched.
I was so lucky because I went into Don't Panic, and I had Joe Wade, who owned Don't Panic, and it was a sort of media company that wanted to move into content. And Joe was like, make anything you want. And we happened to have the same humor, and we just made some weird ass fucking crazy shit.
Yeah.
And it became popular. Luckily stumbled into BBC Three, where Zai Bennett was the commissioner, who was like, and Sean Hancock, and they were like, love it, we'll back you to the end, do whatever you want, we'll fucking back it. We'll argue to the bosses at BBC that they need to do this stuff and be brave.
So did you have to, was there like no pitch? Did you have to do like a pitch document or anything?
Yeah, we did a pilot.
Okay.
I think we did a pilot for Channel 4. This is the thing, we did a pilot for Channel 4. They didn't want it.
Did you film the pilot?
Yeah. Wow. And took it to BBC, and we found our commissioner at BBC that got it, and he commissioned it. Right. This is the way that TV still works, and it's fucking
archaic.
Yeah. And now you just film it, you know, people like Munya Chihuahua, I don't know if you know him.
Brilliant.
He's just so surreal, and like, it's so popular.
Yeah.
And if he'd have gone into Channel 4 like 10 years ago and pitched that, they'd have been like, people won't get that.
Yeah.
It's too, people don't know about politics. People don't get it. And like, it's so cerebral and it's so smart.
Yeah.
And it's great. And people get it.
Yeah.
Because people aren't stupid.
Yeah, and now he's in a position where he doesn't need to go.
Doesn't he? He can call the shots.
Yeah, exactly.
Starting to. Yeah.
I was talking to actually someone the other day. They're like this like serial startup entrepreneur.
Mm.
He's like, well, how can we disrupt the commissioning process? What can be done? Could we get a bot who sort of decides for them? Sort of. I was like, I don't know if it works like that. That's the thing.
It's done.
It's
been done.
It's been done by social media. Yeah.
The downside to it is that you get TikTok. That's the downside, because then you get like, all right, fine, Munya Chihuahua's got what, like 350,000 followers, but there are people who have got 10 million followers that just do dance videos on TikTok.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It is the sort of curse of democracy, right? Where like, if you democratize content, there are enough idiots out there to make that shit popular.
Yeah, I mean, it started off on YouTube with vlogs.
Right. Makeup tutorials. Yeah,
it's just within the wrong demographic, man. I wish I was born 50 years later, you know.
Yeah,
missed out.
I wish I was, it's true. I wish I was a, what do I wish I was? I wish I was a fit female makeup blogger who was 25.
I'm sure it's like a lot of hard work and fair play to actually, you know, just the idea of like consistently releasing content, that in itself, I've never personally been able to do. Like, fair play
that
to
is the
that.
Key, I think.
Yeah,
you can. That is so important. Munya is not a good example because he releases a lot of content and it's all really high quality. A lot of people release like really low quality content, but it's incessant.
Yeah,
and then they get loads of fans. It's just like the sort of, it's the quantity, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's quantity. Not
do you
quality.
Think if you started over now, that's what you would? I'm not saying and did vlogging. Do you think you would sort of like, I don't know, do characters or?
I don't know. I've taken a. My new thing is to try and make loads of money.
Right.
Yeah, I don't really care about being creative anymore.
Get to that.
I'm joking. I do. I've gone on a small segue.
I don't know if you know, Steve, I've become a VC.
I've gone on a small segue where I've been trying to create just like really populist mainstream like entertainment content.
Yeah.
And like, I want to, you know, I'm selling it to like Spotify and like just trying to make money.
Okay.
Because I'm sick of...
All right, see, okay.
I'm sick of... making political satire.
But you've done well out of it.
No.
What do you
Where's
mean?
Where's all my money?
Okay, hold on. So you've done Revolution Be Televised.
We had some,
Revolting.
Yeah.
Yeah. The US series.
Yeah, we had Democracy. We had loads of shows on BBC and Channel 4. We did Ministry of Justice on Channel 4. Yeah, I mean, we had shows on TV.
Doesn't
loads.
Pay. Doesn't pay.
Where's all my money?
I don't understand.
I don't have any. Where's all my money?
But you're like the co-creator of that show, aren't you?
Yeah, but like you can't. Shows that are about British politics, where are you going to sell those shows to?
If I wrote
The Office,
yeah,
and it was optioned by every single country in the world and remade, I'm a multimillionaire, like Ricky Gervais. If I wrote a show about David Cameron and Nick Clegg, and taking the piss out of Tony Blair, who's going to buy that?
Right. Okay. So you're going broad now.
I'm going broad. Yeah.
You're going broad.
Sex. That's my
sex thing. Lies and DM slides. Mm-hmm. Okay. So jumping ahead, but we're on that subject now. So talk to me about how that come about, because you're not presenting that.
No.
So are you the creator and producer of that?
Yes.
Podcast
series. Yeah. So I'm the creator and producer of that.
Okay. How did that come about?
Well, I'm the co-creator with Sydney Lima, who is one of the hosts, and she got DM'd. She's quite hot, and she got DM'd by a guy who wanted to have sex with her for money, and then she wrote a sort of open letter to Vogue about it, like, fuck you, dude, I'm not a prostitute just because I'm hot and I'm on Instagram. And then there was another guy who sort of, she had all these funny stories, like a guy who was wanted to be her financial slave, where he just gave her money and he didn't want anything back. It was just a turn on for him that he was financially disrespected. He was like a masochist. Wow. So, and lots of people have these stories now, right? Like social media and sex. It's like made everything super weird.
So weird.
Everything's weird.
Now. Yeah.
And relationships have changed fundamentally. Everyone's met
ghosting.
Online. Ghosting, yeah. And breadcrumbing. Do you know that one?
No, what's breadcrumbing?
Breadcrumbing's where you, I think it's where you, it's when you lead someone on.
Okay.
It's where you lead someone on social media. So like, it's like, you know, maybe you kind of want that person to be around for when your relationship ends.
Right,
You're teeing it up. Right. Or, you know, you just want them to fancy you. So you kind of do some likes and make a few comments and some DMs.
Okay.
And then you keep that person there. You're sort of putting the breadcrumbs down.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's haunting.
Okay.
That's where your ex-girlfriend or boyfriend is always the first one to look at your Instagram story.
All right, yeah.
You know about that.
Do it all the time.
So, like, there's all this weird shit etiquette, and then we talk about that. We've got, like, Lily Allen on and Rose McGowan, and everyone opens up their inbox and they talk about weird messages.
Right. Yeah. But going back to what you say, like, you know, not earning loads of money from your former projects, I guess one of the advantages of now being in a position where you've got a track record, opportunities like this to pitch your ideas to the likes of Spotify must be a lot easier. As in, like, you know, there's not as many, there's gatekeepers, but you have access to them.
The access to gatekeepers thing is interesting. How do you navigate that? I think that whole world is changing, because when I started out, you still had to have an agent. I mean, even when I started out, that era was coming to an end, right? Having an agent.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's still a great thing to do, but I don't know if that model is going to be around for that long, because if you can get to a commissioner or a producer that's got a great relationship with the commissioner and you're in that scene, you're in that world, what's the function of your agent? Really, the function of an agent, I guess, is to sort of negotiate your contracts. Mm-hmm. But if you understand, I now feel like I understand contract law quite well because I've been doing things kind of myself for about a year.
Right.
But
You don't currently have an agent now?
I think I still do. I don't really talk to her.
Right, okay.
She doesn't respond to my emails. But it's not her fault. It's like, what's she going
to... You've gone too broad, Hayden. No. You're trying to make too much money. We're not interested.
It's got so much money now.
We like you when you're niche.
Yeah. But you can get a lawyer. Like, a lawyer is a good person to have. There are plenty of lawyers now that are like managers/lawyers.
Sure.
That's great, because then you've got someone that's really going to be hard-nosed on the negotiation, because they know how to fucking negotiate.
Yeah,
they've studied, you know... They study contract law and they know exactly how you can get the best deal possible for your show.
Yeah.
And you can concentrate on just being the social networker, being in that scene. I think almost every single person of sort of note, every single like prolific person in the arts, film, you know, art, music, whatever, is almost have always been people that are in that network. Mm-hmm. You know, they all know all the other people in those networks.
When you say close. Networks, do you mean fellow performers?
Yeah, fellow performers, right. Fellow writers, producers.
You think that's where a lot of opportunities come from?
I think so, yeah. I'm not particularly good at it, but I'm better at than some people. I know other people that are much better at it than me, but like that's not even a theory. There are sciences of networks, like people like, who's he called? Niall Ferguson, the historian, wrote a lot about this. And Henry Kissinger writes a lot about this, you know, the war criminal.
Yeah.
There are whole fields of studies about how networks work now.
Okay.
And you can literally predict someone's ability to be successful based on the number of nodes in their network. So a node is like another person.
Okay.
Right? So how many people in your network? And your sort of potential to become successful is directly related to the number of nodes in your network. There are studies around this. So for instance, traditional working class communities, right, don't have much sort of possibility of social mobility, right? Particularly perhaps earlier last century, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're sort of a working class community, perhaps, you know, you've got a very small number of nodes. For instance, you live in a sort of very family orientated community. A lot of people, I'm going back 50, 60 years here, a lot of people work in the factories, whatever, and then you mm-hmm. come home, your community is your local family, your cousins, people that live in your area. Quite profound connections, but not a widely dispersed number of connections,
sure.
Right? People now that know thousands of people not particularly well, okay? So they probably don't hang out with most of their cousins and family anymore. Their connections are large in number, but sort of quite superficial.
Breadcrumbing everywhere.
Professional breadcrumbing. Yeah, literally have to do that. Like, you know everyone a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's probably quite a sad way to live, but it is known to be the way to become successful because you are, it's, you know, you spread your nodes.
Mm.
You've got those connections.
Yeah.
You know who you can call up, the producer at the production company or the, you know, the commissioner. You know how to get to those people. You met them once at a party.
Yeah.
You can't call them when you're depressed and, you know, on your own lying, you know. Crying in your bed, but that's you want more of those connections.
What are you up to? When's he coming round?
I'm the commissioner of the BBC.
It's funny you said it. It's taken me a long time to. I think it was a gulp. I said long, long. It's taken me a long time to work that out. When I set up my production company and I was originally doing branded content. I think you were doing, that was sort of your parallel as well, wasn't it? I used to just like cold email ad agencies and like constantly, hey, my Steve.
That's good then, right?
Is it? Like, I mean,
I think that's
like,
what I'm talking about.
I would have thought it's more of a case of knowing someone who knows someone. Can you set up a coffee with me with
you're
that person?
Right. You're right.
It's a slightly more intelligent you're way, right. whereas mine was sort of like banging my head against a brick wall.
Yeah.
A bit more tunnel vision, you know?
Yeah, it's true. It's the sort of 3D chess thing, isn't it? It's like, okay, I'm not going to email the MD of that branding company. I'm going to work out the party that he's going to be at, and then I'm going to try and talk to him at the party and have a beer with him, and then he's going to be my mate.
But I think maybe the anomaly to that is once you've built up a certain track record, then you can do those emails. Because if you include in that summary, hey, I'm Steve, I've done X, Y, and Z, then you might be taken a bit more seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I find that as well. The number of times, I mean, I don't know how long it will last, but the number of times I find myself in situations where I can like reference the stuff I've done or awards and like suddenly people trust you and you get the job. So like it breeds more work.
Yeah.
But then you have to keep that up. But what I think is interesting and what I was under the misapprehension and no one taught me any different, my parents, school, when I graduated, I was under the misapprehension that creativity was enough, right? And if I produce something brilliant, then that's fine. Like, I just got to produce the most brilliant thing and everyone will recognize it as such. It's absolutely nonsense. That's like 10%, I think.
And I think it's probably yeah, that formula is even less so now. It's even less important.
Yeah.
Obviously, the creating of the thing needs to be done.
Mm.
But like now, there's so much noise. You've got to do so much to cut through.
So much brilliance is overlooked, you're saying. Totally. It's like what you were saying about the guy
Jeff
on stage. Yeah. It's happened so often.
Yeah. And so with that in mind, with Don't Panic, did you guys, I mean, it's different times like from then and now, but did you guys have specific strategies to get your videos out there?
Yeah. So our strategy was to, what we were doing is we were, which is what everyone does now, is we were riding the sort of news waves so that something would happen, right? Like, an MP would be caught claiming that their second home was, that a home was their second home and for expenses purposes, or they'd have, claimed a duck house and fiddled their expenses, or right. they'd, whatever. They'd be,
seems like such innocent times now.
I remember that scandal, yeah. Fuck, that was like the beginning of everything, I feel.
Yeah.
That was when everyone got disillusioned with politics. What was it, like 2007?
Around that, yeah.
Or the financial crash. Whatever the news story was, we would like ride the news story with a viral video. So like financial crash, for instance, RBS, when all the stuff about RBS was coming out, we went down outside RBS to collect money for a new charity called GBFMYC. Okay. And we go up to bankers, RBS bankers, Royal Bank of Scotland bankers, and be like, hi, can you spare some money for GBFMYC? And they'd be like, oh, what's that stand for? Give us back our fucking money, you cunt.
Yeah.
And like, we just do stupid shit like that. But it was riding the waves.
It was so timely. Waves, yeah.
But right. People still do that, I think,
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember when I was making sketches on YouTube and my channel got signed to then Maker Studios, who were part of Disney. They were all about tentpole events. Yeah, so create content around those tentpole events, but broadly speaking, create a video around Valentine's Day or something along that.
It works.
It does, yeah. Yeah, it does. You've got to stand out somehow. Yeah. So back to Revolution Will Be Televised.
Mm.
When you won the BAFTA, so then you've got a bit of spotlight on you.
Yeah.
Would you describe your situation then in terms of your how well known you were? Was there an aspect of you entering this new world? Because you've come from this background where, you're quite self-contained and now there's sort of more eyes on you. Mm. Was there pressure with that? And how did you find moving into sort of like the entertainment world? Like, was that suddenly, were you going to all these parties getting pissed and all that sort of stuff? And what was sort of a knock-on effect from that?
Yeah, for sure. I didn't, I don't think I used those opportunities particularly well at all, actually. I remember I was breaking up with my, I remember I had an argument with my girlfriend the night of the BAFTAs and I was really upset and, literally like tearful before I went to the BAFTAs, and then got really drunk and lost my BAFTA and didn't do any networking at all and just felt shit the next day.
Did you find the BAFTA?
I had to buy another one. I think someone from Made in Chelsea nicked it. Well, I left it on the side of the dance floor to dance and then came back and it was gone.
How much did it cost for a new one?
About 500 quid.
Jeez. Yeah. Bloody hell, they pay you 500 quid to make the show and then you've got to spend it straight.
I know, yeah. But yeah, there is that. That is a real thing to watch out for, I think. For sure. Because once that stuff starts happening and you're like, BBC going to all their like parties and reward events and all that sort of shit.
Yeah.
It's very easy to forget why it is you're doing all that stuff in the first place and to, get a bit distracted, for sure.
Right.
And yeah.
Was it fun though at the same time?
Yeah, it's great fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why you get sucked into it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's so much fun.
Yeah. This is what I got into the game for.
Exactly. That's right. The thing, is that why does anyone ever get into the game in the first place? It's so they can go to award events and drink champagne, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And tell a story about how someone from Made in Chelsea
nicked your BAFTA. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just basically for the anecdotes.
Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like Balancing Acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
You do like all these different things, and I guess from what you're saying, you've done them in separate chunks. So you had time, producer, director, and then host, and then also presenting.
Mm.
Do you enjoy having that variety, or you at a place now where you're like, hey, you know what, actually, I just want to be this now. I just want to be this creator, producer, person behind the camera.
Mm.
Or have you always liked this sort of jumping around and trying all these different vehicles?
I feel like one of the reasons I jump around is because I don't have the confidence in myself to do one thing, which right, I think is a thing. And I think a lot of people do that, actually. But I actually don't think it's the dumbest thing to do, because there are plenty of people that do that, and it gives you something to fall back on.
Yeah.
In fact, so many people that I know that are doing really well as stand-ups now in comedy worked for me as like assistant producers or runners.
Oh, really?
Back in the day, yeah, loads.
Okay.
And, you know, that's a model for all sorts of different, for in TV, and, you know, Vice uses that model a lot. People that are producers end up being hosts or whatever. It happens a lot. And
yeah.
I think it's really good not to, even really established people, as, you know, Stacey Dooley has been busy all of this, even though she's the sort of go-to foreign affairs documentary host for sort of, I guess for a younger viewer in the UK.
Yeah.
She spent all this time, you know, working on her sort of camera skills and editing skills and producing skills and making sure she's got that.
Yeah.
Because she's not going to be a host of those things forever.
Yeah, smart.
Yeah.
It's like lots of actors who then go on to become producers and set their own production companies.
Mm.
Yeah, longevity.
Yeah, right. But I think that there is, on the flip, I think that, yeah, it is quite, I found myself sometimes, you know, like if I, sometimes what I do creatively is I'll like do something, you know, I'll do some producing or do something boring that I know is not really what I need to be doing. So for, I don't know, for instance,
is that procrastination?
It's productive procrastination. So there's a, and sometimes it's worked and sometimes it hasn't. Like, you know, I remember last year I was writing a lot of scripts on spec because,
script, sort of like what kind of, is this comedy
like,
or?
Yeah, like some comedy scripts that, you know, like Baby Cow wanted to buy a script, and this is the danger in TV. And it's a fucking quagmire. You've got to be really careful. I know some really successful writers that spend so much of their time, you know, they've had a lot of stuff on TV and they still spend so much of their time writing stuff on spec for production companies and channels in the vague hope that it gets commissioned. 3 months down the line, they finish the script and it doesn't get commissioned. And it's just so unfair. And I've, you know, I did a lot of that last year. And it's a really hard thing to know how to do, because what I'll do in those scenarios is I'll put off writing the script is what I really want to do, right? Yeah. I want to write the comedy script. It's my dream script. I've come up with the idea. Love the idea. If I got it commissioned, it would change my life forever.
Yeah.
But then something else will come up. Someone will be like, oh, Hayden, can you make this small film for this charity that want to do this? And it's like, oh, the budget's not great and I'm not going to get that much money out of it. But it's really quite simple and there's not much creativity involved in it and I could just do that really easily.
Yeah.
So I'll procrastinate on the dream script.
Right.
And I'll just focus on this shitty little film and it'll take me 2 weeks to do. And I'm just doing budgets and call sheets and I'm getting it done.
Right.
And it's kind of like, it's constructive procrastination.
Yeah.
But then I've been fucked over on the dream scripts. So it's hard to know where to put your time and attention.
But
you know?
Isn't that the challenge that comes with being a creative, doing what you do? You have to constantly have that balance between, one, paying the bills.
Yeah.
And then, paying the bills and doing the practical stuff.
Yeah.
But also I find, with the dream job, with the dream projects, but I've found, I don't know about you, but my experience of doing all the producing is like what you're saying before about Stacey Dooley, that has massively helped when it comes to my sort of projects that I hold dear to my heart, that I'm then more involved in a more creative aspect, where I'll be directing.
You know how to do them.
You know how to do them. And if you're not doing, you know who the person, what that person who is doing it should be doing.
True. That's true. Yeah. It's good to have that breadth of experience. And in fact, that's what frustrates me so much about commissioners is they've never worked in production half the time.
Yeah.
Or they've never written a script and they're giving you notes on it. And it's like, ah.
And it's how do you find, because what I find challenging is navigating notes.
Yeah.
Because it can be a bit of a head fuck because you can end up questioning yourself. Well, maybe they're right. Maybe, you know, how do I have like whole conviction in my own original idea and everything that comes with that. And I've got to be a team player. I've got to take on board their notes.
Such a hard balance. I've got friends that are really bullish and are like, no, it's like this.
Does that work out for them?
I don't know, because I'm more of the team player kind of guy. Like I tend to just like try and make it work and like take every note on board and like, and I liked, and maybe the grass is always greener, but I've seen guys like, I've seen people like that. It's quite a high risk strategy because you can fuck people off really quickly.
Yeah.
And then if the commissioner's not on your side anymore, or the, you know, then it's bad.
It's game over. And it's like there's an abundance of talent. So it's not like they need to work with you again.
But they do. But like people in those fields respect conviction, like creative conviction. It's like if you know. But then on the flip of that, that can be quite uncreative. Like I've often found in writers' rooms, people who have the most conviction in what they want to do are often the least creative.
Because they're not willing to take on board other people's ideas.
They're just not willing to sustain other ideas and other ways of getting to the, you know, if you've got like you're in a bit of a sort of cul-de-sac with your script, you're trying to work a way out. And if you just want to like drill your way through a wall and be like, that's the ending.
Yeah.
You're generally going to have a shitter ending than if you spent more time working out another route.
Part of it is like, I know part of it can be sort of like laziness. I've come up with this now. Yeah. I can't be asked about something else.
Oh, they get it. They get together and live happily ever after. Come on.
I know we've seen it. But we're going to do it. We're going to shoot it really nicely.
Yeah.
A little bit creatively, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We'll frame it well.
Yeah.
It's a shit ending, but we'll frame it nicely.
Mate, wait to see the grade.
So they get together and live happily ever after in the suburb. Yeah, but the grade is going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
Commissioned.
You got it. Yeah. It's like the easy way out to get a jail card.
Yeah.
So have you been involved in writers' rooms where you are working on someone else's project, or has it always been writers' rooms on your own scripts?
Yeah, it's always been on my own scripts actually, which is
okay.
I really like to get into a writer's room.
Would
and
you?
work on someone else's thing.
Mm.
That would be such a good gig, man. And in fact, that is someone should pay me to do that. No one's paid me to do that. I don't know why, because I'm a good like team player in a writer's room, and I'd love to do that. And there are so many, there are so many great writers' room in the States, man. If you get on a show,
it's crazy, isn't
like
it?
You
different
know,
ball game now there.
Yeah.
You not wanted to do that? To that whole thing.
Yeah.
The US thing.
I'd love to. I need to try and work out how to do that.
Have you like attempted to do it in the past?
Little bit. I'm gonna make. Can I make a note?
Yeah, you're going
to do that. I'm gonna make a note on my iPhone. Get into a writer's room. Yeah, that's the shit, man. Because then you like, so many people that I know have gone from those writers' rooms to have their own shows.
Yeah,
it's a real like way to like prove yourself. But they don't exist in the same way as they do in the UK.
And if they do, they're much smaller, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a real closed circle. Whereas those writers' rooms in the States, like, they just cast their net wide for the talent, and they like,
and the budgets. I mean, in terms of like, you know, what you're getting paid, it's completely incomparable.
If anyone wants to make TV, get to the States, because I've just had a friend who is one of the best directors of docs in the country,
right?
BAFTA winning, and has just had a show. I don't know if I can say this. He had a show commissioned on Channel 4, and then Channel 4 turned around and said, look, we really want to make it, but we just went to see the accountants and there's no money left. Like, they want to make his doc badly, and they just don't have the money.
Crazy.
There's this, we're fucked in this country. Yeah. We're fucked.
So what, is he taking him to the US?
No, I mean, I don't know what he's going to do.
He's just got his hit a brick wall with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no industry here.
But then you kind of also feel like, well, there's the streamers now, and there's like Netflix UK that are picking up stuff.
That's nice to happen. It's true. They opened the UK office, yeah.
Right. And then you can also pitch to Apple and Amazon now and all those guys. So there is like a wider net to a certain degree than there was.
Yeah, I don't feel like, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know the degree to which the sort of UK offices of those companies are really, how much shit gets sent through back to, I mean, you're better going to the source.
Yeah
I think.
Yeah, okay. We've gone very industry, but that's fine. No, it's me. I've just curiosity. Because it amazes me, like, you know, I look at you, we've had, you know, these shows made and this track record, you'd think yeah, the doors are going to be open and all those opportunities are there for you.
It's hard. I'm really, you know, I struggle to get in. I'm now in a situation where, like, I know loads of commissioners and I probably could make better use of my connections. You know, I know commissioners at Netflix, at Channel 4, at BBC. I've got like, I've kind of got insane connections compared to a lot of people, I guess.
Yeah.
But I really struggle to get through the door with ideas that are taken seriously and commissioned, you know. I've just spent last year writing up a really commissionable NC as part of my big money plan, like entertainment format,
okay,
for BBC,
yeah,
and got a great production company on board and who are like getting loads away. I guess it coincided with the lockdown,
right?
The BBC wanted to talk about it, production company were about to option it. And then it all sort of went quiet, and now BBC are like, yeah, sorry, maybe take it to Channel 4 or ITV.
Right.
So I struggle. I mean, I'm really hard.
It's tough.
It's really hard.
And do you prefer to, on these projects and on your scripts in general, do you prefer to write on your own, or do you usually co-write and co-create with people? Do you like to collaborate?
I like to I've got some people that I've collaborated with for years that I like to collaborate with.
Okay.
I find it's always, depends who you are.
Yeah.
I'm more of a, I like having other, I like, you know, being able to spitball. Apart from anything else, I find it really hard to sit on my own and write for long periods of time on my own.
Same.
I'm quite like ADD, so
yeah, I'm
having
well.
Someone else there to is really useful, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And just you're going to come up with better ideas with someone else. They've got a different perspective, point of view.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Depends what you do, I guess.
Like so when you are doing projects on your own and you need to, like, you know, you hit a brick wall, dead end, what you do to conjure up or to get that inspiration or creativity? Have you got any sort of methods or tricks that you
use? I used to drink wine.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm not sure how productive that's been.
Right.
So now I think reading.
Okay.
It's like, I always find, I get in this, I don't know if you ever get this, but I get in this like, I get in like a headspace where I'm like obsessed with finishing something that I'm writing and can't work out how to finish it, and I'm thinking and I'm just like, and I'll spend like an hour and a half, 2 hours sort of sitting there adding very little to it, a couple of sentences, and then I find that I can't break away from the computer to do something else because I've got like an insane like work ethic, so I'm like, I have to be there, got to finish it, but it's not really working. It's sort of like having that obsession isn't helping the project. And if I take a couple of hours off and I read a book and I go for a walk and I come back, I'll finish it in 15 minutes.
Sure, sure. So do you have a general structure to your day? On days where you're not like, you're not on set or you're not doing something specific, how do you structure your days?
That's really hard. I'm not very good at that. I want to ask you about that because you do the whole Buddhism thing. Is that something that's helped you? Because I get really cluttered often. Mm. I find like, I almost need a lot on to be able to do stuff. If I've got too much time on, I can't finish anything.
Having too much time, it's like the conversation happened before we started.
Yeah.
Having too much time is the scariest thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you're panicked.
Yeah.
What do I do now?
Yeah. We were saying earlier, we wanted to have kids just to have more to do.
Just to have more to do. Yeah, exactly. I think it's a good enough reason. It's valid, isn't
Not
it?
Not necessarily with each other, but yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. We could do a creative adoption. We could be like, look, a couple of writers, we haven't got enough on. We want to adopt a small child.
Hey, this is a sitcom.
This is
how we're going to make our money, right?
Great. Yeah, let's do it.
Great. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. If there's any commissioners
listening. So we have to say we're a gay couple.
Yeah.
We adopt a small kid to fill the hours. Because we find we're more productive when we have more on.
Yeah, and then we write a sitcom about us being fake gay lovers and taking a kid. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that sort of makes us our millions. So it's like quite a meta comedy.
And then we have to sort of, you know, follow through and get married because otherwise our careers would be over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we have a falling out because series two gets commissioned and basically one of us does a sort of sneaky deal with the production company and basically the other one gets kicked out. So they don't get any rights on the second series.
Yeah.
So then we get divorced and...
No, it's got to be a love interest. One of us has got to go off with a woman and get caught
by
the media.
It goes
viral. Gets papped.
There's a pile on.
Yeah.
as a pile-on.
Like, you go off with a girl, and everyone's like, how could Steve do this to Hayden? He's broken up their marriage. And then we fall out like that.
Yeah. And the kid, the poor kid.
Yeah.
Kid's all right. He's young, doesn't he?
We don't care about the kid.
No, I don't care. Just, it's fine. Yeah. Okay, no, great. I think this is great. It's got a lot of legs.
I think it's good. Let's write it.
Yeah, great.
What were you about to say about the...
I was saying that... to answer your question,
Buddhism
affects me in a way... In terms of positive, I meditate every morning. So that just gives me... What I find it does, it kind of like... it controls the ADHD.
Right.
I'm like, I can notice what I'm like when I'm not.
Right. When you haven't meditated.
Yeah. It helps with creativity, I'm sure of that.
What's the difference?
When I'm not meditating.
When you have, yeah.
It's more of like, because I do it every day now, it's just part and parcel, but I feel I'm less likely to, in terms of more general things, I'm less likely to react to things like on a subconscious level. Without really thinking things through or let things affect me as much. But in terms of my creativity, often some things, ideas will come while I'm meditating. And actually, from a much broader perspective, I would say that pretty much everything that I do now comedically is inspired in some way by a Buddhist philosophy. So that was it from a grander scale. But in terms of how I structure my day...
Does it make you more productive?
I would like to think so. I guess it has, because opportunities have happened since I've got more into it.
Yeah.
But in terms of the structure, that's I'm big on like morning routines. And then I will try now to do the creative stuff in the morning and then practical stuff, answering emails in the afternoon. But that doesn't always work. It doesn't work. The phone, man. The phone's a fucker. It's like I've really been toying recently, just delete all the socials. I don't have a big social following, so what am I doing?
Yeah.
It's for me, sometimes it's my own entertainment, the ADHD stuff. Like, let's just do something, a funny little story. Yeah. I don't even do sketches on there anymore or anything. Yeah. I do nothing.
Why not?
I've taken a step back from stand up just to actually focus on doing more of the writing stuff and, you know, that and directing. And I don't know, like, I don't like how it makes me feel.
Yeah.
I don't like the feeling of putting something out there and the anxiety that comes with it not getting likes. And I was like, then I'm a prisoner to the algorithm. I was like talking to, do you know Joe Jacobs?
No.
He's a stand-up and he was on here, I was on the podcast recently and he was, his term was slave to the algorithm.
Yeah. Yeah, we really are. It's, God, I mean, TikTok is the best example of it. It's like people going onto an app developed by an awful sort of regime that's banging up Uyghur Muslims and horrible surveillance state in China. And they've programmed it so everyone that's on there does the same thing. So there's a song and you have to do a dance to the song that they teach you how to do.
Yeah.
And everyone's like robots. They're going on this app and they're doing it. And then like 5 million people are liking it.
It's crazy, isn't it?
What are we doing?
It's mad.
And then... When you write something that you're proud of and you put it on social media and then, you know, you get like a few hundred likes when fucking dance, routine on TikTok's got 4 million likes, makes you feel so shit about your creative process. You're like, why am I bothering? Why am I bothering? What is the point?
Yeah.
And everyone's an idiot. The whole world is full of idiots that don't appreciate
understand my
genius.
Yeah. Your stuff always does well.
No, man, I get into loads of shit. It does really fucking badly.
When you say badly, are you calculating that on lack of likes and comments?
Yeah, just like lack of views, lack of likes. I put loads of shit out. It just does really badly. But you just got to keep doing it, right?
That's the thing, you can't let it affect you. Guy I know called Sean Burt, really funny character comedian. I was talking to him about this and he was saying he was really depressed last year because he questioned everything that he made and he would just not put it out. And then he just thought, fuck it. And he's just been solidly putting out like 2-3 sketches a week, character stuff for the last... But you know, that's a certain type of person. He's on like 50,000 followers on Twitter or something. And it's working for him. But you've got to be that way inclined.
Yeah.
And be all right with being that
hard
ingrained in your social media.
Yeah, if you're a sensitive flower.
I think it's difficult.
Yeah.
But you know, we're fine. We're getting right. married, we'll be soon. Right. We'll have our kids. Yeah. Move to suburbs.
Yeah, be fine.
Sell the script.
But I do think there's something in hardening up like that. I mean, I know it's a sort of age-old sort of creative. It's an age-old strategy that people who are in the creative fields have used to protect themselves, because you're putting so much of yourself out there.
Yeah.
You know, that I have friends that will write something, or, you know, music or something else, and then they'll spend ages on it. They'll write a whole album, let's say, and then they will just keep it in a drawer on the computer.
Oh, wow.
And they won't put it out because it's like the fear of releasing that thing for everyone to judge it. It's just terrifying, and it's so much worse than... But then that's how the only way you do it. It's like Woody Allen has made a film every year for the last 20 years. And how
many... Did you read his biography?
No.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, I read it there. But anyway,
it's good.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, there's all that shit around him right now, but he's an incredible filmmaker, irrespective. And but is he? Because that's the thing, is it's like he's written and made some of the best films I think that have ever been made. Mm-hmm. But I know five. I can name five or six of them.
You don't.
How many has he made? Hundreds.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah,
you take that sort of ratio onto your Instagram posts, and you've got to assume that half of your Instagram posts are going to do pretty badly.
But also, like, I exaggerate how much, or in my head, how much people care. People don't give a shit.
No,
it's literally one second of their life.
Yeah.
They look at it, move on.
Yeah.
Even if they make a judgment, they don't like it. That's move on to the next thing.
Totally. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Okay, so and then one other thing I wanted to ask you, that you've got into stand-up recently. That's a relatively new thing, isn't it?
Well, actually, I did some last year.
Okay.
And then I haven't done any since.
Okay. Yeah. Why did you start and why did you stop?
I started because I'd never really done stand-up. And I'd always done... Luckily, I was able to just drift into TV shows, which is kind of insane, because a lot of people have to spend years doing stand-up, which is brutal, before they get a TV show.
Yeah.
But I wanted to prove to myself that I could do stand-up because I'd never done it. So I learned how to do stand-up and worked out how to do it and wrote it. And I think...
When you say you learned, how did
just
you learn?
Died on stage a bunch and worked out how to do it.
So you did like open mic?
Yeah, before, did open mic nights.
Yeah.
Some went well, some were fucking awful.
Yeah.
Oh, but I don't know about you, like you said you're not doing it anymore, but I think doing it has made me realise how little I want to do it.
Right.
Because even some of my, even some of my friends who are really successful relatively in the comedy scene and I spent years doing it and have got great followings on social media and do sold out gigs. It's not a life, man. Do you really want to be going?
That's what was a big part of my thinking.
Unless you love it, unless you love it, getting up on stage, which I don't, because I find it scary and I have to overcome it to get up on stage and spend, you know, unless you love it, do you really want to be going to Harlem on a Friday night when you're 45 to do a show to 200 people and then get the train home on your own? Do you want to do that?
I mean, you don't want to be going to Hull at 25, let alone 45.
Ever. Sorry to anyone in Hull, but it's true. You don't want to go there.
Yeah, I had a friend, mutual friend, who went to university.
Yeah, went to university in Hull.
Yeah, I went up there once, did magic mushrooms
in Hull.
Drove back, drove back in the middle of the night on the motorway.
All mushrooms. The way from Hull.
Mental.
How long did that take?
I don't remember, it was on mushrooms.
20 minutes.
Felt like an eternity, to be honest.
That's like a 4-hour drive, isn't it?
Mental. I mean, the sort of stuff you're doing in your youth.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
I remember being on mushrooms and driving a motorbike, and I couldn't work out whether I was going really, 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 really fast or like 2 miles an hour. And I think what was happening is I was going like 2 miles an hour. In my head, I was like taking course, like... This is crazy.
Yeah.
But actually in reality, it's like...
My experience was, I was looking in my Wimmer and I kept on seeing this car in the distance and in the horizon. And I thought it was a police car, but they weren't coming near me.
Right.
They were just sort of staying far enough to sort of follow me.
Yeah.
And so I drove on the motorway 30 miles an hour.
Right.
Because I was trying to pull me over. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a nice paranoia mushroom trip.
Yeah.
Why didn't you just stay in Hull for a night?
Why did you drive? That's how bad Hull is.
Yeah.
I had to leave.
Say no more.
I had to get out of there.
Yeah.
All right. So Outside of career stuff, what do you do to unwind and relax and take your mind off career stuff? Can you take your mind off it?
Alcohol, sex and drugs mostly.
Okay. Yeah, but they are the three founding principles of Buddhism.
It's true. Are they? Why haven't I been into this before? No, I really want to go. I wonder if that Buddhist center's open, I'd love to go with you. If you ever,
100%, you should come. You should come. Yeah, I've just started. I'm on the team on Friday nights now. Mm. It is such a nice way to start the weekend.
Well, I mean, because it is, in answer to your question, like, I would love to be able to be doing more of that stuff. I tend to... You know, no, I mean, I read a lot. My meditations, I read a lot. And that is, for me, meditation, because it's just like clear my brain and that's great.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I play football. It's hard when you're, if you're doing, especially the high, sort of high intensity stuff, the high adrenaline stuff like stand up.
Yeah.
It's hard not to go out and pursue high adrenaline, high intensity relaxation. Hobbies, because that's what you're used to,
right?
I don't know.
What form would that take for you then?
You know, like, I don't know, did you never find that sort of going out and, like, you know, if you go out and you shoot a bunch of sketches, then you go and have some beers to relax rather than like going and relaxing. You're not actually relaxing when you go and have some beers. You are for like an hour and then you're not.
Whatever form that would take, that need for adrenaline.
Yeah.
That's what a therapist said to me recently. I'm addicted to adrenaline.
Yeah, that's been my problem for years. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's hard to come off that.
Yeah.
It's hard to come off that. And I guess, going back to what you were saying earlier, that's what meditation has definitely helped.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's so important. I'm not good at it. I think you're probably much better at it, given that you've, you know, your meditation, which I don't do, but I've noticed the times that I've done a bit more of that, you know, I've been much more productive.
Yeah. Right. And talking about books, are there any books over the years that stand out to you that have had a big impact on you in any way?
I've just read a book. Well, I'm halfway through a book that is just, it's killing me. It's amazing.
Really?
Yeah. It's the best book I've read in ages.
Okay.
It's really inspired me. It's called Anti-Fragile. Okay. It's by a guy called Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Remember that book? Black Swan. This guy wrote a book called Black Swan in like 2003, where he predicted the financial crash.
Okay. Right?
And he became this huge sort of economics megastar. And like, he was an academic, but like, I think he used to be a trader, and banks would bring him in to like predict when the next crash would be.
Yeah.
And he's just written a new book called Anti-Fragile, which he says is his main thesis, because Black Swan was everything was leading up to this.
Right.
And it's like an economics book, but it's like a self-help book.
Okay.
It's not supposed to be, but it's teaching me all sorts of stuff about my life.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it's like profound and it's amazing. And it's about, it's, is it, should I talk about it? Is that interesting?
Of course.
So he says that there is a phenomenon that exists in every major system on the planet, right? Whether it's biological systems, physical systems, whether it's economic systems. And it's, the notion is what he describes as anti-fragile, anti-fragility, right? Mm-hmm. But there's no word for it. He's had to put anti and fragile together. There's no word for it in any known language, right?
Okay.
Dead or alive.
Right.
And what it is it's the opposite of fragile, but it's not robust, right?
Okay.
So he gives you this thought experiment. He says, let's say you had a box full of 27 champagne flutes that you wanted to send to Outer Mongolia, right?
Yeah.
And you put fragile on it, right? What would be the opposite? If you were putting something that was the opposite of fragile, what would you stick on that? What would you stick on that package?
No need to treat with TLC.
or no, drop, please drop as much as possible.
Okay, yeah.
Kick this box.
Right, yeah, right.
Rough
it up a bit.
Rough this box up as much as you can.
Okay, and that gives you a bit more sturdiness. Well, not, it doesn't give the box sturdiness, but as
it gives the box sturdiness. So this
right,
is
okay.
Literally, if you think of your immune system, right? Mm. When you get a vaccine, you're stressing your immune system a little bit by giving it a little bit of the virus as a way to overcome viruses, the more harmful strain of the virus. If you're if you're a kid and you're sheltered in your home your entire life and you never go out and get any life experience, you're not robust. You can't like learn how to overcome challenges. If you're evolution is an anti-fragile system, because the more you stress species, the better species become at overcoming those stresses, right?
Right.
So it's the notion of like how stresses, lots of small stresses, make you better at things.
Okay.
And that's how you prevent black swan events. Black swan events is when you shelter yourself from small stresses all the time, and then a massive one comes along that you can't handle.
You're not prepared for.
So you have to, and that's the thing about posting stuff on Instagram and failing. It's like you have to fail, and that's the Google, wasn't that the Google mantra? Fail fast, fail often, right? You've got to fail all the time because it's a way of getting information.
Yeah.
If you're not failing, you're not getting any information about what doesn't work.
Yeah.
So you have to constantly be failing as a way to be not just robust, because robust is just like a house that survives after a hurricane.
Yeah.
Anti-fragile is a house that's better when the hurricane's gone.
Got you. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And that is so applicable to kind of working in a creative job or trying to start out in a creative career.
Yeah.
You've just got to keep putting stuff out there and not be worried about.
You've got to enjoy the video that you put up. It doesn't get many hits because you're like, right, that's information for me.
Yeah.
I can now be better as a result of that.
I just finished a really interesting book by Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh, yeah, right.
And it's about her creativity process. And she is like, I was like, wow, if I had read this at the start, I think things would be a lot easier. A lot of the time she talks about having these ideas and that they're going to be with you for a certain period of time.
Mm.
But if you don't make it or if nothing happens with it, then that idea is not meant for you. It's meant for somebody else.
Yeah.
And you have to be okay with that.
Yeah, there you go.
And also to be very grateful for all those opportunities where you do fail.
Yeah.
Like that's an opportunity to be grateful.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and not just grateful, but like, it's information. That's what I found mind-blowing. Yeah, because it's like, what he describes is how if you're a bodybuilder and you start using heavier and heavier weights.
Yeah.
Not only do your muscles get stronger, your bones get denser.
Right.
So the extra weight that you're piling on your body is information for your bone. Your body is using that as information. It's saying, I need to get my bones denser because there's a lot more weight on me every day now.
Yeah.
This guy's lifting heavier and heavier. This woman's lifting heavier and heavier weights. But your bones get denser. How insane is that?
Yeah.
And that, I think you can take that analogy and put it into comedy and creativity. If people aren't not, you know, if I'm not dying on stage at a comedy night, like if you do it all the time, get out of comedy. But if you've had some good nights, or you've had some good videos, and then you had like three shitty videos, that's just information. Like you're going to get better as a result of that. I just love it as a concept.
Yeah,
because it makes me feel better about my failures.
No, I think it's a super, super important lesson to learn and take on. Okay, final question I'm going to ask you. I'll ask all the guests to come on the podcast. What does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
God, I don't know. I'm really bad at balance. So it just means being happy, isn't it? Like maintaining an even level of happiness, spreading it nice, not putting like butter on a piece of toast. Like if you put all the butter on the nice like chunk of butter on the first bit of the toast, don't have any left for the end.
I hate when that.
And then you've got to eat dry toast.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like that.
Great. Great.
What does it mean to you?
I've been like trying to strive. I think for many years I was my whole identity was wrapped up with my career and having success. And as soon as I get to that place where I have success, then I'll be happy.
Yeah.
So you're never really living your life. Whereas now I do put a lot more emphasis on experiences.
Yeah.
And, doing things outside of my career.
Yeah.
So that would be a balance.
Do you find your creative more creative as a result of that?
When I'm able to remember it.
Yeah.
I'm not always able to remember that.
Yeah.
You know, and when I'm in the hole.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really easy trap to fall into. So I just need to get this thing.
Completely. That's exactly what I'm saying about the reading thing earlier. You can't write about stuff if you don't live the stuff. You can't go and like spend your whole day sitting on your computer writing something and not go out and have a relationship, because what are you going to write about?
What are you going to write about? Exactly. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And this is the past year and before COVID particularly, I really made an effort to go on adventures, random adventures. Yeah. And like you said, experiences happen and that informs creativity.
Yeah.
Where can go on. No, go on.
I was going to say, where can people find out, but we're talking about social media, etc. But where can people keep in touch with what you're up to work-wise?
Just Hayden Prowse, HUYDONPROWSE on Twitter and Instagram, I guess.
Okay. All right. Great, man. Thank you so much for doing this.
Nice one.
Coming on.
Yeah. Thanks,
wicked.
Man.
Wicked.
Cheers, dude.
Cool.
Thanks for having me. Perfect.
And there we have it, Hayden Prowse in the building, and this one was literally in the building. He braved it and came over, and we did a face-to-face. We were in touching distance of each other, and we have both lived to tell the tale. So it's worked out well. I hope you enjoyed that episode. As I said at the beginning, it's packed with nuggets of gold. I hope it was useful and somewhat insightful. So that's it from me. Until next time, see you later.
Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.